Good afternoon. I want to apologize for being late. This is Meade Treadwell, Lieutenant Governor, and I have the list of the folks who are online, and I want to thank you all for being here. This is a public hearing on Ballot Measure 4, which is an act providing for protection of Bristol Bay wild salmon and waters. We have a short presentation, which we'll be doing here in Barrow, with a slideshow that gives a summary of the bill and a summary of the cost estimate on the bill. Then we will open up testimony to Anders Gustafsson with the Renewable Resources Coalition, the sponsor of the initiative, and then an opposition statement by Alicia Amberg with the Alaska Miners Association. And we have online representatives from Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Natural Resources, and Department of Fish and Game, who can answer questions about our current permitting process and how that permitting process may be affected by this bill if it were to pass. We have one attendee here in the room in Barrow right now, and some others who were in the library who said that they wanted to come back, and so we'll see what happens there. But we are also being broadcast statewide through the LIO network, and others may be listening in. This is part of a legal requirement that we hold two hearings on each initiative in each of the four judicial districts. So we had a discussion about this on the radio today and advertised a number of different ways here in Barrow. And so I appreciate everybody's participation. We'll move quickly. The first thing I should say about the proposed bill is the bill would attempt provide protection of Bristol Bay wild salmon and waters within or flowing into the designated Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve by requiring legislative approval for certain large-scale metallic sulfide mines. It would also require a law finding that the proposed mining operation will not constitute danger to the fishery within the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve, and would be in addition to other permits and authorizations already required for such mines to operate in the region. The summary and a sectional analysis of the bill basically adds that new statutory provision with three subsections, the Alaska Statute 38.05.142, legislative approval required for certain large scale mines, the Title 38. And it says, in addition to permits and authorization otherwise required by law, the legislature must give final authorization for any large scale metallic sulfide mining operation located within the watershed of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. The Commissioner of Natural Resources would be in charge of adopting regulations under the Administrative Procedures Act to implement the statute. And it defines large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation as a specific mining proposal to extract metals, including gold and copper, from a sulfide-bearing rock, and that would directly disturb 640 or more acres of land. The other sections of the initiative would add new provisions, the uncodified law of the state, containing 10 specified findings by the people. The findings would generally provide for recognition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve as a region of statewide significance to sport, commercial, and subsistence fisheries, Alaska's economy, the global fishing economy, and a region of cultural importance to Alaska Natives. The provisions outlined in the initiative do not retroactively take effect on any existing mining operations throughout the state. Now, let me just say that if this bill were to pass, I as the Lieutenant Governor, certify the election returns, usually a week or 10 days after the election is over, depending on how close the measure is, the number of question ballots out there, and so forth. But we certify the election returns, and a law that passes becomes effective 90 days after certification. That law is not subject to veto and may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of its effective date. And that's under the Constitution's Article 11. And although the legislature may amend the initiative at any time after it's enacted, any amendments made during the first 2 years may not operate to effectively repeal the initiative by amendment or vitiate the intent. In other words, go against the intent, and there are several legal cases where that issue has come up. We did a cost estimate on the bill as required by state law before the bill went out to collect signatures. And the estimate of the costs include what it costs us at the Division of Elections to run the initiative, and that's about $71,257. We have a cost of about $9,000 toward these hearings and advertising the hearings and so forth at the Lieutenant Governor's office. And then the Natural Resources Department estimated that they would need to spend $70,000 in personal services of $52,000 and $14,000 in travel, $4,000 in supplies. So a total of $70,000 for the department to administer the bill. We also heard from the Alaska State Legislature that they estimate it will take $50,000 to advise agencies in regard to processing public record requests, legislative review, process and hearing documents, agency regulations review and revisions. So I should just say that for that, we've seen the legislature from time to time actually hire legislative consultants and so forth, and they might choose to spend more money or less money on this bill. So you've got the $50,000 estimate for the legislature, the $70,000 estimate for Department of Natural Resources, which oversees permitting of large-scale mines in the state, and the approximate $70,000 that we are spending at the Lieutenant Governor's Office and Division of Elections. At this point, what I would like to do is invite Anders Gustafsson with the Renewable Resources Coalition to speak on the bill. And do we have a slideshow here to go up? Anders, we're just going to be going on you audibly. You now have an audience of four people besides Cameron and myself. And we will hear from you next.
Sounds good. Thank you, Meet. I appreciate that very much. Again, my name is Anders Gustafsson. I'm hoping you can all hear me okay. I'm calling you in from Homer, Alaska. I was actually out moose hunting until yesterday, so I just made it back in time. Otherwise, I would be there in person with you. I wanted to just touch on a few things in breadth of our support for the initiative. I guess I have one follow-up question on the costs, because since we are amending existing law, I would assume that some of these costs are already in place if an oil and gas lease were to be pursued. So I was just curious as the additional cost, just because it would be reviewing a mineral lease as opposed to an oil and gas lease. So I'm curious on that note from your side. But that's just a question that I had. One of the things that I just want to touch on, first of all, is when we think about Bristol Bay and Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve and the importance of it, both economically and culturally to the state, I think it's an incredible value and an incredible resource to our state to have this fishery that pumps in over $500 million in annual revenue to the state every year. And that's just including the commercial harvest, not including all of the sport fishing interests and lodges and tourism business that takes place. And that doesn't take into account the subsistence lifestyle and how much of value in food and protein levels that there are from being able to harvest all of the salmon and not having to import and ship all of your meats and things in. So there's an incredible importance there, and I think Alaskans have understood and recognized that Bristol Bay is an incredibly valuable resource to our state. And while mining can also be valuable in many parts of our state, we feel that the conflict of interest or the conflict that occurs from the renewable to the non-renewable industry deserves a heightened level of review and scrutiny. And we support ballot measure 4. In part because we think that it's been in place for 40 years. It's proven, tested law that's been there since Jay Hammond and the state legislature created it in 1972. And we think that it's a reasonable and practical approach to make the oil and gas or the mining industry follow the same rules and regulations that the oil and gas industry has been forced to follow for 40 years in the same region. So amending the law is the least amount of conflict, bureaucratic nightmares that you could think of trying to get through, to actually put in some kind of a meaningful public process back into large resource development questions in Alaska. We think that having the legislature have a final review will give us a more cumulative approach to looking at the impacts of all of the individual permits on their own. We have a strong permitting process in Alaska that's been tested and used for a lot of activities throughout the state. But one thing that I feel that we're missing is a comprehensive look at the impact of all permits together. Each permit looks at generally an individual sequence of events or silo, if you will, for each individual action that some company wants to do, whether it be dredge or fill or use water here, create a road there. But there's very little public review, meaningful public review, for anybody to take a look at the impact of all of those permits together and what that would mean both culturally, economically, and at the broader range. So adding this little bit of review at the end of a process that would not circumvent that process, the permitting process would still be allowed to go forward in its fashion, which it would be modified or changed at its by the legislature's choosing, but it would be after that. So one way we're doing that is, or one thing that's important is adding that public process back in. I think we've lost some of those opportunities in the past in the state, partly with the loss of our coastal zone programs and the ability for people and communities to weigh in on big projects. In a small way, this replaces some of that, at least for the region of Bristol Bay. And we really are concentrating on that fishery. It's a unique opportunity to change the laws for that region and not the whole state as a whole, because Bristol Bay is important to the whole state. But it's a specific region, and we don't want to be affecting other projects in other parts of the state. So again, our support is for ballot measure 4. We would like Alaskans to support that and support salmon and the long-standing resource that we have in wild salmon in Alaska. I think that pretty much concludes some of our opinions on it. I wanted to keep it brief for questions and see if there's anything I can answer.
Thank you. And Anders, just before I go on and invite Alicia to speak, the law requires us on a cost estimate to give the incremental costs of the new law. And so because this adds a new step in the permitting, the incremental costs were, one, the additional costs at the Division of Elections to hold the initiative process in the first place, two, the cost for DNR to provide information to the legislature, which would be expected to ask lots of questions to the agency before they actually legislation that your law requires, and three, the money that the legislature might spend itself to get questions answered. So if an oil and gas lease came up, which also has the legislative provision that you mentioned, presumably the legislature would appropriate that kind of money to DNR and to DEC, but since it's already on the books, the process of getting that money might be exactly the same as this process, but it is an incremental cost.
Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah, thank you. I was just wanted a clarification.
Yeah. Now what I'd like to do is invite Alicia Amberg from the Alaska Miners Association to speak against the measure.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay,
yes, we can
so
hear you fine here. And a question, do you have a slideshow? Or?
I do not. So, hello, my name is Alicia Amberg. I'm with the Alaska Miners Association here today representing the no position on ballot measure 4. So, ballot measure 4, the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative, stands to politicize the permitting process by requiring legislative approval in addition to the existing National Environmental Policy Act process, the NEPA process, and other permitting requirements that would take place at a mine in Bristol Bay. Now, the problem with citizen initiatives, in our opinion, is that they have too many unknowns, and this is no exception. We have a question, what has the potential to adversely impact even mean? It's unknown. It brings uncertainty to Alaska's investment climate and sets a bad precedent that can easily creep into other venues in Alaska. And it will certainly pose an additional burden to the legislature and permitting agencies without any added benefit to our environment. Above all this, the initiative is very likely unconstitutional, The constitutionality of the existing Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve has never been tested in courts. Our Constitution prohibits special and local legislation. And most importantly, the separation of powers has had a serious concerns, and that's been expressed by at least one Alaska Supreme Court justice. So finally, it's important to note that ballot measure 4 will not stop Pebble. Should the Pebble project submit a mine plan and receive the multitude of permits such a project would need, then at that point, you know, denial by the legislature would be purely political. We believe that Alaska's permitting process should be scientific, not political, which is why our position is to vote no on ballot measure 4. And that's all.
Thank you. Now what we have on the agenda is an opportunity for people here at the hearing in Barrow, as well as others who may be listening in around the state, to ask questions of the proponents and the opponents, as well as the DEC, DNR, and Fish and Game representatives on the phone with us. I'd like to invite anyone forward who'd like to testify or ask questions. It's your opportunity. Is there anyone here in the room who'd like to say something? Looking at Forrest and Glenn, both of whom have been listening intently. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor. My name is Forrest Ulimone, Barrow resident, lifelong Alaskan. I think I can certainly bring a certain view as to and share my opinion of this whole deal. I'm a little protective when it comes to a referendum such as this that could affect me either way, if I was for or against something like this, that if it's going to happen in my immediate area, I would hope that the federal and state government would ask me first, because if it took me and my family and our ancestors before them that have used the natural resources around the area for decades upon decades, is now in question because other interests want to come in and do something else besides what has sustained the livelihood of the people in the area. I think this is one of the main reasons why we felt here on the North Slope that it was important to start a port authority process to oversee any future oncoming issues that can affect our area, like seismic exploration or development offshore or offshore, for that matter. And so I became somewhat intrigued by this whole pebble mine process and trying to get both sides of the story. And my question is the resistance to mining. I'd like to get a little more understanding from the pro side, and from the con side, I'd like to hear on what grounds and science are they saying that it'll be okay in the long run? Thank you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor.
That's a question posed to both the pro and the con side. Would you like to take a stab at it, Anders?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. Thank you, Forrest. I appreciate your insight on that, and I agree with you on the concept of having some local knowledge and understanding being an important level of this discussion at a higher an earlier time in the process. I think that's part of the reason you see this initiative being supported and sponsored by three sponsors from the region. People who commercially fish, one gal who lives in Igiaugig and lived there her whole life and relies on the subsistence and the fish, and another from Dillingham. So we have a good broad sponsorship, and a lodge owner, somebody who owns lodges in the region, which generates a lot of economic interest in there. So I think that my answer also kind of correlates a little bit with what was pointed out as being a problem with the initiative, saying that this kind of an approval could add, you know, more skepticism to doing business in Alaska and could creep out further and cause, you know, unintended consequences. I think it's pretty clear, looking at the law that was already been in place since 1972, that we haven't had much problems permitting oil development in the state of Alaska, even though we were able to add a level of protection to Bristol Bay itself. So I don't necessarily agree with that argument that she had made, saying that, you know, this could affect other things and making it a political interest. It's always been that way. And that's the best process we have for deciding complex conflicts and questions for our state. And I think that you're right about, you know, on the North Slope, you've seen a lot of this development going on and worked and balanced it all out. And this is what we're trying to do here as well, finding a fair approach that adds another level of sophistication to our arguments and our decision-making processes here in Alaska. Did I answer any of your question at all?
Well, everything you've elaborated on was expected. I just thought I might hear something different than what I've already heard from others. But I thank you for that.
So you're welcome.
Like,
yeah.
Hi, this is Alicia.
Yeah, please go ahead with your.
Forrest, the plain and simple answer to your question on, you know, how can we, where is, and I'm not wording it correctly, but how will we know this is going to be okay in the long run? And the short and simple answer is we can't judge a project before they've even come out with a mine plan. I mean, Pebble hasn't even come out and said what exactly they're going to do yet. And so we can't judge a project. We don't know yet because we haven't seen anything they've come out with.
So let me, if I can, just along this line of questioning, then we'll go to another witness or testifier. Anders, what you said is you want a more comprehensive look at all permits. And I guess the question I've got is there any objective standard in this deal? If for example, you know, my project, and it could be anywhere in the state, can meet water quality standards, say, of sediment or of you know, the water quality, you know, chemical analysis or something like that. If I show that I can meet that and I don't get the permit, I have a right to sue to say, hey, listen, I met your standard, give me a permit. Or if, conversely, if the agency gives a permit to somebody who doesn't meet the standard, a third party has the right to sue to say, hey, you gave this permit to somebody who can't meet it. Now, what you're adding on here is a new permitting hurdle with, would you say it's an objective standard or a subjective standard? Because the law, as you proposed it, says that you have to make a finding that that it won't affect the fisheries. The legislation required says
correct.
That I'm trying to find the exact language here.
Yeah, it's a.
in Section 1, you say is authorization that it must be obtained by the legislature, take the form of a duly enacted law finding that the proposed mine will not constitute danger to the fishery. So what constitutes danger?
Right.
I guess the question, and is that an objective standard or a subjective standard?
Thank you. It's a good question, and I had that same question about it when I first read and drafts of this initiative and as it was coming through the process, and that was a point of question for a lot of folks trying to figure that out, so I'm happy to try and answer that the best I can. I'm not a lawyer, just to preface this, but as I understand, when you have a duly enacted law to and et cetera, like I said, have a finding of no danger, you hit the nail on the head there. And as I understand it, the difference between danger is basically the equivalent of risk. Is there a possibility that a large-scale mining project could affect the fishery of Bristol Bay? Not a finding of harm, where they say a large-scale project will kill fish or will affect the fishery or has affected the fishery. It's a difference of risk versus harm, which is actually, the actual implementation of, doing something. So it's a tough standard because you can't play around with it. It's not something you can get back. So I think that's where the further definition, and someone from a legal standpoint could probably clarify this for us if we needed to, but I understand the term danger to mean risk to the fishery, and not just to one fish, but a risk to the fishery in general, where the runs would no longer be sustainable or large parts of rivers and habitat and breeding systems would be removed that can't be replaced, that could affect the total volume of the fishery. And these things are going to be objective standards because you have to prove somewhere in the world that you can do this kind of activity in these kind of watersheds. And it really hasn't been done before. So there's going to be, it's going to be a high hurdle at the end of those hurdles to try and prove that. But I think that's where that at least that's the closest answer I can give you to that without being a lawyer and defining the term danger.
Right. So a second question, Section B there says the commissioner may adopt regulations under 44.62 to implement this section. So conceivably, could the commissioner define risk or danger in Section A and then feed that to the legislature? And I guess that the first question is, what your intention is? And the second, how does that balance with the balance of powers issues that was raised by the other side?
As far as I understand, the balance of powers issue that was raised by the other side is that has been brought up in court and handled there. Again, I'm not a lawyer to understand the balance of power separation argument. But I do know that was brought up in court and was dismissed from all of the different hearings on it in the court case, judging the constitutionality of this initiative, which was held up by the Supreme Court to prove that it is a constitutionally viable initiative. So the commissioner adopting those standards, I would need more clarification. I don't know if that was the intent of the draftees to have the commissioner decide and then dictate to the legislature what danger would constitute. I would assume that during this process and the public hearings that legislatures would then look at this law and see what standard they need to meet and then apply, their knowledge, understanding of that law. And maybe Ledge Council advises them on what that standard really would or what danger would mean to them or risk. But more importantly, I think, than that is that you're basically getting a public process again where this isn't being decided only through the permitting system, because in a special area like Bristol Bay, we deserve to have more opportunity for everybody to look at the bigger, larger scale and larger impact. And that's going to be held, and maybe that is a little political, but that's the system that we have. That's democracy in action. And we'd like to see that take place when we're making decisions as at this level. And again, if you look at the initiative, I think it's important to understand that it is singled out large-scale hard rock metallic sulfide mining, mines like Pebble. And the argument that this doesn't stop Pebble, it's true, it doesn't in a way. And that's not what we're trying to accomplish. We're trying to accomplish getting more public review of this process and met levels of protection and conservative judgment over deciding whether to take a large risk with something as valuable as our fishery?
Thank you. So, Forrest, do you have any more questions?
I think without respect to the Lieutenant Governor, the line of questioning just raises more opportunity to continue to try and define exactly what the final process would be. And, you know, when I hear the gentleman that was just commenting, is that it's still political in nature, and it would depend on who the commissioner at the time is. So that still raises more questions in my mind if when I go to the polls in November to what do I vote on this initiative? It would seem that when voting on an initiative, you already know what your outcome should be when you're favoring or opposing such a process. So I'm still, I guess, needing more clarification. I can certainly understand the wanting to protect the area from reckless disregard. And I think everyone wants to do that, to make sure that everything is done in a sound and safe manner, whether it be mining or oil and gas exploration. But at the same time, you know, the times that are changing pretty rapidly, and you know, we're in a technological era where a lot of our children are becoming more apt to doing things a little differently than we did 30, 40 years ago, and as time progressed. And so that there's always that inherent danger of apathy of, you know, whatever the flow is doing, it must be okay. And so I just want to make sure that, because this, you know, could certainly be the foundation for things to come, not just for this referendum, but for any others in the future pertaining to mining and oil and gas.
Thank you for your comment. We can't tell you how to vote, but
understand
the question of whether or not there's an objective standard is one that it's interesting because it sets a standard about risk or danger versus harm, and I appreciate those words, Anders. The question of how you define that is an important one. Let me ask, is there anyone else who would like to ask questions or testify either here at Barrow or on the phone line? Dr. Glenn Sheehan, I'm going to call you to the front of the room.
Yeah, and this is a financial question that kind of comes out of what Dino was asking. To assume that the mine is there, it's productive, then after some period of time it's not productive. Does the state have resources that have come out of the mine productivity to monitor and take care of the impoundment for the future, or to the Fed, or, you know, or the people that permit the mine ultimately wind up when it's not productive with the impoundment, who pays for that monitoring and any corrective action? And the same way, if it failed somehow, is there provision for taking care of the people who are making a profit and subsistence out of Bristol Bay? So that, I don't think that's addressed exactly by any of this, and it's probably a question for DEC and EPA, but you know, who deals with that? Do the owners of the mine pay into the state or the feds on the way? How does that work?
We have three people on an account. Moselle from the DNR is involved with mine permitting, and also DNR oversees reclamation. Michelle Hale, she is there, and I know that in some cases you have financial responsibility laws. Tom may be able to talk about, Tom at Fish and Game may be able to talk about payments to fishermen. Would you three agency representatives like to address that question about financial responsibility after the, you know, if there's impoundment left behind and there's problems and what kind of bonding is required in the state's current permitting system, regardless of what happens in this legislation?
Sure. This is Kyle Moselle with Alaska Department of Natural Resources. I can start, but I'm sure Michelle Hale might have something to say. She's on the line as well. She's with DEC Water Division. So, Michelle, if it's okay with you, I'll start.
Please do, Kyle.
Okay. So Alaska Department of Natural Resources is the lead agency for reclamation and securing financial assurances, what we generally refer to as bonding, for mining activities, regardless of land ownership. So the authorities of Alaska Department of Natural Resources for reclamation and financial assurance for mining activities applies to state, federal, and private land when there's locatable minerals being mined or explored. So to your first question of who pays for the monitoring and care, I think is what the word you use, but I'll use the word reclamation, but that does include long-term care and maintenance. That responsibility or that obligation falls to the project proponent, the mining company that has been authorized to conduct the activity or make the disturbance that's been approved through the permitting process. So before a mining company can start implementing their plan of operations, their approved plan of operations, they must post financial assurance in the amount necessary to fully reclaim that area after the mining use. Now, I'll define the term reclamation. It's different than the term restoration. Simply put, reclamation is returning the land to a stable condition compatible with future uses. It's not returning it to a previous pristine state or any of those other types of restoration to a previous state. It's a stable condition, but one that is conducive for future uses. So that's reclamation, and a mining company is obligated to do that post-mining. Typically in mines in Alaska, what we will have is a 30-year post-closure, so post-reclamation monitoring program that will require of the company. And then most mines can be free from their liability after that once 30 years post-closure monitoring demonstrates that everything is stable and that there's no areas of effect beyond that. But if the mining operation is such that there's a longer-term impact that needs to be cared for or maintained, I think the example you used, sir, in your question was an impoundment. Let's suggest or say that an impoundment needs to stay in place forever. Then the mining company would be obligated to to assure that that happens. What Department of Natural Resource has available to it in one of its funding or one of its financial assurance mechanisms is the authority to work with the Department of Revenue to establish a trust fund, a revenue-generating account for those long-term or perpetual care and maintenance needs following a mining activity. In that situation, the mining company would need to pay into a trust fund that is approved by Department of Natural Resources and Department of Environmental Conservation and managed by Department of Revenue. And that's an acceptable financial assurance mechanism, and it's intended for those long-term care and maintenance costs. To your second question, what happens if this is how I interpreted your question, is what happens if an individual is impacted somehow? The financial assurances are there to ensure that all future reasonable reclamation activities are taken care of. It does not account for unforeseen or catastrophic events. So the financial assurances that I just described are there to close the mine down properly, reclaim the area that's been disturbed, and care and maintain that area for as long as it needs to into the future.
Thank you. Glenn, do you have a follow-up question?
No, it's really interesting because I haven't heard this addressed at all for these ongoing discussions.
Well, kind of a corollary to the question, and I'm not asking for a complete litany of the current permitting requirements, but I guess the specific question I'd like to ask the three agency folks here, when a mine is permitted, what are the major permits that are usually required, and do any of them have what Anders was saying in his presentation represent a comprehensive look at all permits? Does something like the EIS kind of, you know, take a look at cumulative impacts, for example, or something else like that? And I'm not suggesting that Anders is wrong in saying he wants more. I mean, that's the intent of the law, as I understand it. But what cumulative and comprehensive discussions happen besides the individual permits on specific water and land use and that sort of thing?
Well, again, this is Kyle Mozell with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. I'll start. Major permits, there's a couple of the big ones. Your reclamation plan approval by Alaska Department of Natural Resources, which includes the financial assurances. That's a big authorization. That's required anytime you are going to disturb more than 5 acres of land in your operation, total acres. So once you go over 5 acres of disturbance, you're required to have a reclamation plan and post bonding. The other major authorization for most mining projects is your Alaska Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit, your APDS permit, which is issued by DEC wastewater program. That is that's an authorization that the DEC issues, but it's they're really administering the Federal Clean Water Act through that authorization. The other major authorization for most mining, typical hard rock mining, would be a waste management permit. That's for your solid waste, your tails or your waste rock. Those are probably the three largest. And then going down from there, I would say that your fish habitat permits from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are probably your next major authorization. There's also the air permits for any emissions. So I'd say those are probably the top five. I'll stop there and let the other agency folks maybe fill in where I might be missing some major permits.
Kyle, this is Michelle, and did you want to talk a little bit about NEPA and how that plays a role here?
Absolutely. Yeah, so let's stick with those five major permits. So you have your mine reclamation and financial assurance authorization, your wastewater discharge permit, your waste management permit, and your fish habitat permit. So let's call those the major permits. Just to give you a feel, the one mine down here in Southeast that I manage permitting for the state, Kensington Mine, it's a underground hard rock gold mine. They have over 75 individual active authorizations to operate. So there's tens and dozens of actual authorizations that a hard rock mine would need to get, but those tend to be the top five, let's call those. Now, when you're talking about, there's a difference between permitting and environmental review. The cumulative effects of a project, that's reviewed through the environmental review process, and that is a process, a federal process, that's mandated by the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. And so it's a national law, and the lead federal agency can change depending usually by the type of activity or the type of effects that that activity might have or the land ownership. If we're talking about the area that the initiative would apply to, the Bristol Bay area, most likely the lead federal agency there would be the Corps of Engineers, and the EPA would probably be a what they call a cooperating agency. So that NEPA process is a federal process that is administered by federal agency, and it's usually done ahead of permitting. That's where you would look to having a comprehensive evaluation of the potential impacts of the proposed activity, including a cumulative effects analysis. And then once that lead federal agency has made their administrative decision of the effects and the mitigation measures to mitigate the significant effects, then that essentially clears the way for federal permitting to occur. The state permitting isn't necessarily bound. It can start before the end of that NEPA process, and sometimes it does, but it usually flows after that NEPA process, but it can run parallel. So it's kind of two different processes in your question there. There are the major permitting things, and but then you get the comprehensive evaluation through the environmental review. The question about are there permits, do we look at permits individually or do we look in them more holistically? Well, that's essentially my job as a large project coordinator. Earlier, somebody had mentioned that the way government likes to organize itself is in silos, and that's true. One of the things that the state of Alaska strives to do is to work horizontally across those silos, and that's what the Office of Project Management and Permitting, my office, is tasked with doing. And so the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, the lead state agency for regulating mining activities, and the Office of Project Management and Permitting works collaboratively and coordinates with other departments, environmental conservation and fish and game, namely, but also across divisional lines within DNR, so that we apply a team approach called the Large Mine Permitting Team, where individual permits and applications for those are shared amongst that team of resource specialists and managers, so that each individual permit that's issued by its appropriate agency is informed by the other resource specialists.
And this is Michelle Hale with DEC Division of Water. Thank you, Kyle. That was excellent. I might also add that the permits and processes that Kyle's been talking about are typically subject to public notice, public review, and the agencies take those public comments received very seriously. We work very hard to permit accurately and adequately, but we're very interested in the review that we get during that public comment period and often make changes to the permits that we are working on as a result of those comments that we receive.
Yeah, and just to give an example of that real quick, this is Kyle again. Two of those top five permits that I mentioned, the discharge permit, the APDS, the waste management permit, and the reclamation plan, DNR and DEC often try to align the public notices and public comment periods for those, and we jointly notice those often. At a minimum, the waste management permit and the reclamation plan. That way the public can see the DEC authorization where they how they regulate the waste material and the tails and stuff, but it's also they're seeing at the same time as that, they're seeing the reclamation plan with the bonding, which both DEC and DNR will approve.
Thank you. Tom, is there anything you want to add from Fish and Game?
This is Tom. Can you folks hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. No, not really. I think Kyle hit on it. We do have one particular permit, the fish habitat permit, that's essentially required at any point a proponent or a company would enter a river, lake, or stream below ordinary high water and want to conduct activities, you know, which could be diverting water or changing the flow or using vehicles, excavating equipment, that kind of thing. And we, you know, within that permit, we also have a role in ensuring fish passage. So that is the primary permit that we administer. And as Kyle said, that's usually done in coordination with DNR and to a lesser extent DEC.
Thank you very much. Anders, just in terms of that process, all those things in that process have to occur before this goes to the legislature. And a question that came up at the earlier hearing, I don't know if you've had any more thought about it, is let's suppose that the project goes through all those permits, gets the approval by the legislature, starts digging, and for some reason or other changes its project plan and maybe discovers groundwater where it didn't think it was groundwater before, or the richness of the ore body zigs instead of zags as was predicted or something along those lines. Does that send the entire, if there's a modification of a permit after the legislative approval, does that send the entire project back to the legislature for approval under the proposed law?
You know, I don't believe so. I think since the project would have already started and everything was underway, that process wouldn't take place again. That would just be operating underneath it. I can't see how that would get reset. That clock would be reset. I think once that decision's been made, that decision would have been made. And I'm not a lawyer, so I couldn't tell you that. I guess, again, that would have to be that would probably be up to a judge to decide that at some point, if that ever got to that point. It's kind of a hypothetical scenario. But as I understand it, that is not the case. Would not reset that because that process would have already taken place. It would just be within that permit that it would be going back and getting redone. I did have a couple questions. If it was all right, could I ask a couple questions of Kyle and just because for clarification?
Yes.
One question you had, you're talking about the 30 years post reclamation, and then they're free from a financial responsibility. But if it's a minor operation that's going to be handled into perpetuity, then you said that the money would be generated or put into a different trust fund and then managed. Is there an example of that currently underway in the state? Because I've seen the bonding requirements for many of the mines, and I think that some of them seem like they're very far from being adequate to – I mean, maybe they can get a reclamation done, but not much more. Is there an example of a long-term fund that's already set up and monitoring a project?
Sure. This is Kyle. Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Again, good question, and the quick answer is no. We do not currently have any mine that is operating or is in post-closure status in the state that has elected to establish a trust fund.
Okay, that's great. And then another question I had was when you were talking about the NEPA process and the federal process taking place, it sounded to me like that takes place prior to a permitting decision. So it's hard for me to understand how that could be a measurement of the cumulative impacts of the permits if the permits have yet to be applied for. But then you answered that in a way saying that the Office of Project Mining or Project Managing, the large mine permit team, is somewhat tasked to basically be that voice. And my question to you then on that is how is that paid for? And who is responsible for covering the cost of that project management team? And how are those people decided and picked? Because effectively that would be, in my mind, the role of this legislation would be to put that process that's happening, you know, it would happen there as well, but then to a larger body as opposed to four or five people in a project mine or project managing team. If you could clarify for me, that would be great.
Sure. So with the NEPA process, that's a review of the potential environmental impacts of the proposed activity. So I'm not sure what you mean by impacts of the permitting. The permitting.
Well, I think I mean by the, you know, not by the permitting, the, you know, signing the paper, obviously, but the impacts of the permits being given or the activities being undertaken by the approval of said permits. How do you know what the cumulative impacts are going to be if you have yet to determine what the standards of the permit are going to be or what the details of that permit are? How do they know? I know this law is asked to be to define, or I was asked to define danger, and here you have a NEPA process that's determining whether this would be a problematic, but before there's ever even any permits being decided on. I'm just curious as to how that works.
Okay, so the NEPA process that's led by the lead federal agency, it ends with a record of decision, and that record of decision describes the significant impacts to the human environment by fully implementing the proposed action. And then it also describes any mitigative measures that the federal agency is requiring be part of the project description. So the NEPA process and that record of decision is describing the significant impacts to the human environment. And as part of that, they do a cumulative effects analysis of what the impacts from the proposed activity are combined with all past, present, and reasonably foreseeable future activities. That's one process. It's separate from permitting. But once that's completed and the record of decision is made by the federal agency, then that essentially locks in the project description and defines the proposed activity. So when permitting then is accomplished, the permitting is taking that project as described and evaluated in the environmental impact statement and authorizing specific components of it based on the jurisdictional authorities of the agency issuing that particular authorization. And once the mining company has received its 70, 80, 100 individual authorizations, then it can go about the business of carrying out its project.
So did you say the NEPA process, the record of decision, is not actually a decision. It's not a decision in a way, though, right? It's just it just kind of describes it. It's more of a trying to articulate that. I apologize, but it's nothing something could be revoked. There's not an approval or a disapproval. It's basically stating what they think the impacts and the reclamation and the whole project would be. But it's not a decision in itself, whether the project can go forward or not.
It's both. NEPA requires that the federal agency describe the significant effects to the human environment by the proposed activity, and they capture that in an environmental impact statement. Their record of decision then is the decision document that must be issued before any federal authorization is issued for that project. So it is essentially a checkpoint. Without a record of decision by the federal agency for an activity, it can't receive its federal permits. And it is an appealable decision by that federal agency. So there's an administrative objection or appeal process depending on their regulations. And once that's extinguished, then legal action could be taken to challenge that decision in federal court.
And did you have an answer for the cost of the Office of the Project Management and the large mine permitting team and how that gets handled?
Sure. That answer is a little bit more straightforward. The Office of Project Management and Permitting does have general fund funding, but the work that we do in coordinating the permitting for large mine projects is paid by the project proponent. So it's a user pay process that pays our process. It's paid for by the mining companies or the other large projects, like the Susitna-Wautauna Dam project. So it's not just mining, but it's large development projects in Alaska. It's a user pay formula, and then what OPMP has reimbursable service agreements, RSAs, that go out to the various departments, state departments and divisions within them that we work in that large mine permitting team with.
Thank you.
We have another question here in Barrow, Dr. Sheehan.
It's not exactly a question, it's more an observation. On cumulative impacts during a NEPA review, at least theoretically, not in practice, they're both reviewing other projects in the area, and the conclusions that have been reached on those reviews and what the proposed project is doing. So at the end, then the decision is, or the conclusions are theoretically telling you everything that could be an issue, not just what's happening with the particular project. And so theoretically, it covers from A to Z.
Thank you for that intervention. And just in the colloquy that we just had between Anders and Kyle, we have a situation here on the North Slope, for example, where lands offshore were leased for oil exploration in Chukchi. The federal government had done an environmental impact statement before that leasing process, and the adequacy of that statement was actually under court review for some period of time. The company got the leases, went forward, got federal permits, assuming that EIS was adequate, and then last year a judge said, no, it was not adequate, you got to do it again. The fact that the judge found was that the field is probably bigger than everybody thought it was, though it's hard to tell what objective evidence the court used to make that decision, but that's what the court decided. And so, therefore, we're now in the process of redoing the NEPA statement after some drilling permits had been issued, but now before any drilling can go forward and take place. So all the other permits are kind of stayed until this EIS is done. But the reason why the court overturned it was because it was not comprehensive enough, or it did not take the full size of the field into consideration. So I can tell you it's because of court decisions like that, the NEPA process, getting the record of decision, tries very hard to do what Dr. Sheehan mentioned in terms of the adequacy, the cumulative impact, and so forth. And I think probably those who wrote the initial EIS, were sorry that they did not write it for a bigger potential project. In this case, I think one of the questions that was raised by your testimony, Anders, was you were looking for a comprehensive look at the, you know, at the permitting process. And the question is, does your proposal to have the legislature do that at the end, repeat what was supposed to be done in the EIS or not? And I say this not as pejorative about the proposal, but we just wanted to get the current permitting system on the table, and obviously voters can judge whether you have that. The other legal questions that came up in the previous hearing, or very simply, you've now stated that it's not your intent that a party would have to go through that. And I think one of the legal questions will be, when does final mean final? Because the legislature's theoretically in your bill is not supposed to do this until the final permits are done. I don't know, having built a house or a deck on my house recently, I thought I had the final permits, went ahead and built it. The inspector came back and said, we shouldn't have issued that. We gave you a different one. And I know that happens a lot in construction. So, aside from the issue of danger, the question of final is there. And perhaps that's all covered by your Section V that says the commissioner adopt regulations to implement the section. So it may well be that there's definitions to come.
Correct.
Are there any other questions that people would like to raise either online or here in the room? Hearing none, Alicia, is there anything else you'd like to say on this at present?
Not at this time, thank you.
Yeah, Andrews, anything else you'd like to say?
Not much. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on. I just want to clarify quickly that, I'm speaking on behalf of the initiative, but I am not the sponsor of the initiative. So I just wanted to clarify that for the record.
Thank you. That's clarified. And I also just want to state, from this office, what we've tried to do in this process is replicate a legislative hearing as much as we can without being an advocate one way or the other for or against the bill, but to simply try to figure out what, exactly how it would work. And, the question about risk doesn't mean you drafted wrong. It just means we're trying to get that explained, or the word danger, rather, and the question of whether or not regulations work before or after that. And I'm just going to say to the three agency folks there on those questions, plus the what does final mean in terms of the process here, it may be worth a huddle to see if we can get a better answer to those questions. Again, not to be one side or the other, but how we would interpret that part of the law and whether it fits that. The other thing I should say, just because, Anders, you made the statement about the Supreme Court looking at the local legislation and looking at the constitutionality. I don't have the Supreme Court opinion in front of me. And when the law was challenged by, I'm not sure who the plaintiff was, I believe it was the producers, the Council of Alaska producers, it may have been challenged by the miners. But our Attorney General's opinion that I relied upon before accepting this measure to be on the ballot states in several places, and that opinion is online, that there may be constitutional issues that don't prevent me from putting out on the ballot, but are the kind of constitutional issues the court may deal with later. So I just wanted to state that for the record, because I don't have the Supreme Court opinion in front of me. But it was clearly contemplated that there's, with all initiatives we have, whether it's this one or minimum wage or Pebble or minimum wage or marijuana or what we did before, several others that we've done before, sometimes the court has said, yes, this may be a constitutional question, but we're not going to deal with it unless and until the law is passed. So
I believe that the issue of balance of powers, or one branch of government being able to tell the other branch of government how to make its decision or to get that, may yet be something that comes up with the courts. And I'll try to get that clarified as well. Thank you all for being here this evening. And the next time that we will address this issue is in Juneau on a hearing Tuesday at noon at the Thomas Stewart Building on 206 4th Street in Juneau. I invite members of the public who are listening now or who may be reviewing this hearing online to submit comments and information about these hearings, as well as the slideshows and anything else presented to us for the public record, will be kept on the Alaska Online Public Notice System, as well as delivered to the legislature, where they keep records of other hearings for legislative intent. Thank you all, and have a great evening and safe weekend. God bless.